Hi, this is Eric Schlein of the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode of the Intelligent Investing Podcast is sponsored by Red Rock Running. Runners and joggers out there, tell me if this sounds familiar. You go into your local running store to pick up some gear, first the shirt, and as you browse the shirts, you see that nice, high-quality performance shirt running you at least $40. Then, you need something to carry your smartphone so you can listen to the Intelligent Investing Podcast while you run. Or maybe you want to track your run with a GPS. A smartphone carrier costs something like $20 or $30. And between work, family, and other responsibilities, the only chance many of us have to go for a run is early in the morning or late at night. That often means running in the dark. So, to help stay safe, you need a reflective vest to increase visibility. That's another $10, $15. So, in total, you can expect to spend over $100 just for gear that goes on your upper body. Red Rock Running has a better way. Their new Bryce running shirt combines all three of those products into one simple item. Secure pockets built directly into each sleeve carry your smartphone or other audio device, a couple of keys, headphones, or energy gels. Strategically placed, reflective material increases your visibility, keeping you safe when running in the dark. Intelligent Investing Podcast listeners know the importance of value. Purchasing a technical shirt, smartphone carrier, and a reflective vest separately costs over $100. The Bryce running shirt, however, gives you all three for only $59. And Red Rock Running is offering listeners this podcast an additional 15% off any purchase by using the promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So that's right, listeners, if you are a listener of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you get an additional 15% off any purchase of a shirt that's already a good value by using that promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So remember, go to Red Rock Running, REDROCK, running.com, and receive 15% off your Bryce running shirt with promo code INVESTINGPOD, INVESTINGPOD. Carry more, increase visibility, decrease hassle.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have Tim Bergen on from OnBeyondInvesting.com. Welcome to the show.
Cool. Eric, thanks for having me.
Yeah, right on. And where are you calling from?
I live in Toronto.
Nice. How's the weather out in Toronto today?
It's freezing, actually.
Is it freezing?
It had been a beautiful month, but currently it's quite cold.
Well, it is a beautiful day in New Hampshire. Not super cold, but cold enough. But I'm indoors drinking some warm yerba mate out of my gourd. It's called Cruz de Malta yerba mate. It's absolutely delicious, and I bought a yerba mate gourd from a company called Kubel, and it's like silicon. It's fantastic. I love it. It's now the official drink of my show. Yeah.
I hope they're paying you nicely for that plug.
They're not, but if you want to pay me nicely, you can email me at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com, and I'm happy to sponsor your product if I actually like it. If it's trash, I will not put it on the show, for the record.
That's fair.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about you. I know a little bit about you already, but because, you know, we did talk a little bit before the show, but tell us a little bit about you, who you are, you know, what the heck you do. I think you have a pretty interesting story, so which is why I wanted to bring you on the show.
I appreciate that. So originally I was a math major, specifically in actuarial science at a Canadian university.
Yep.
And they had an internship program where every other semester you would work. And as part of that, back in 2005, I believe it was, I landed an internship on a credit trading desk in New York, in Manhattan, for one of the big five Canadian banks. So I interned with them twice and joined them out of school in, I think it was 2006. And on that trading desk, you know, I traded convertible bonds, credit default swaps, corporate bonds, interest rates, you know, a pretty wide range of products. And I was in New York, you know, had a seat during the financial crisis, which was pretty incredible to watch the CDS market during that period.
I bet.
It was. It was wild. In 2009, the bank asked me to move up to Toronto, where they're based, to help out with a problem portfolio. So I moved up to help sort that out. And in total, I worked for that bank for, I think, just over 10 years. After that, I decided to try the hedge fund world. I worked at two credit-focused hedge funds. Mm-hmm. And then I left a little while ago just to do my own thing.
Right on. And what had you want to leave the industry to go out on your own?
You know, it was mostly freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, while it was an incredible experience, and I worked with some incredibly intelligent people, you know, at my time at the bank and at the different funds.
Yep.
You know, unfortunately, in the investment world, you're very much siloed. You know, this is what you do, and then specifically on the hedge fund side, you know, your primary goal often is asset gathering. Mm-hmm. And so you're incentivized to really be long with the crowd rather than do something differentiated or different, or simply just sell products that, you know, people want to buy.
Yeah.
I always had trouble with that model. I guess my personal style is, I think, you know, one should go to where the value is. And oftentimes that's outside of the mandate, and that is outside of what's currently popular.
I love your Canadian accent, by the way. So.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
You know, so being on my own or just managing my own money, it gives me the flexibility to do lots of different things. You know, I can look at buying private businesses. I can, you know, take advantage of international opportunities or different securities. And also, you know, I was primarily a corporate bond or CDS trader.
Yep.
And given low yields, you know, the landscape wasn't that interesting. And then obviously there's the personal freedom. You know, I get to spend more time with my wife and my son and, family. And, you know, I think it ultimately should lead to a more interesting life. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thesis anyways.
Yeah. So what had you want to start? I've looked at your website and it's pretty interesting. You have this background, right? And now you can buy private businesses, as you were just saying. You could buy, you know, do international investing, whatever. What kind of, you have a free range of stuff. Out of all of these things, why did you decide to start a newsletter rather than, say, start a private equity fund or a hedge fund or, you know, something like that?
Good question. You know, to start an investment fund in Canada is actually quite, is the regulatory burden is quite substantial.
Is it even that way? So like, for instance, like with my firm, I do manage accounts because I didn't want to spend all the money to launch a hedge fund. Are you able, say, if you were to do managed accounts under some advisory platform, is it still pretty much a headache in Canada to do that, or is it easier?
It is. You need to be registered specifically to be able to manage money, and often they want a CFA and, you know, experience in your particular industry and so on and so forth.
In the States, it varies state by state. There's a few states where you don't need any license. You can literally just start. In New Hampshire, where I live, you need your Series 65 license, which isn't that difficult to start.
I think actually I have that. All right. I don't. I have Series 55. But, okay. You know, I never bothered getting my CFA.
Yeah.
I always thought that, you know, if I spent that time studying credit markets and trading, I'd be better off in the long run. And I think largely that was the correct decision. So, you know, never say never.
Yeah.
I may at some point do something like that. But even still, you know, given the overhead required, it's largely an asset gathering, mm-hmm. or would be initially to start. Whereas I think I'd rather just, you know, manage my own money at this point and have greater personal flexibility and also have greater security flexibility in what I choose to invest in.
I can see that for sure. But why would you say greater security flexibility? I mean, if you say ran a fund, you would have a lot of flexibility. I would assume.
It depends. You know, very often, you know, especially with my background, people would want to see me start a credit hedge fund.
Right.
I don't think that's all that interesting at the particular moment in time. I would much rather do equity or some hybrid.
Yeah.
And then you're obviously committed to selling that strategy that you picked, right? It's much easier to sell a niche strategy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the private equity side, you know, potentially that is something that interests me. But, you know, given my young son and family and such, you know, at this point in time, the newsletter seemed like kind of a nice hybrid between the two. You know, I still get to share ideas. It's still the intellectual challenge. And, you know, I write about positions that I have on.
Yeah.
Or that I'm researching. And, you know, I kept getting asked for ideas or help with investing by friends and family. And this seems to combine, you know, the parts of investing I loved and still allow a lot of personal flexibility. But,
so
you know,
for you, it's really a lifestyle.
Absolutely.
Very cool. I mean, and you're a great writer, by the way. I wouldn't have had you on if I thought your newsletter was shit. Just FYI.
Well, you can thank my wife.
Is she the editor? Is that the deal?
Yes, absolutely.
Right on. Well, your wife has a...
She's a good way of turning my words into coherent sentences.
Right. Awesome. So let's say, for instance, you know, I was, you know, you obviously have a good sample letter, interesting website. If I decided to subscribe, what can I expect from your newsletter?
Well, the goal is really to be educational. So I want to give my readers, you know, an idea of how a professional approaches markets and values companies. So in every issue, there's going to be, you know, a general thoughts on the market or themes to look out for, or important concepts like, you know, why is management so important? You know, why do we need to have a view on inflation and interest rates? You know,
right.
Where is there potential pitfalls ahead? Where could there be potential opportunity? You know, even though the market's expensive, is there still stuff to do?
Mm-hmm.
Then I will give, you know, updates on previous ideas, some news or blogs or whatever that's shaping my thoughts at the current moment in time. And then there will be two very in-depth company write-ups. You know, when I take a look at a company, I tend to go quite in-depth. You know, I speak to management. I speak to other owners of the stock. I'll go to annual meetings. You know, I'll go through all the filings, presentations. And I do a lot of the due diligence that, you know, a lot of my readers probably just don't have the time to do themselves.
Right.
And so this accomplishes two things. I think it shows, you know, a very detailed valuation of a company, and also it shows the approach and the thinking behind searching for value or opportunity in markets. And, you know, as I get more readers, I also, you know, since this largely is a lifestyle thing, I intend to plow a lot of that money back into research. So, you know, more management visits, flying to annual meetings, that type of stuff.
That's very unique, actually. Most newsletters don't do that. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is, you know, being a corporate bond trader, you tend to have lots of positions in lots of different companies. So over the years, I've probably traded, you know, I don't know, thousands of different companies, different securities, all this type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Spoken to many management companies, looked at lots of different industries. So there's kind of this database of experience I have that I hope to share with readers. You know, I tend to find that everything in markets are cyclical. You know, ideas, fads, different strategies.
Yep.
And through my experience, you know, you develop a way to spot these things. So
right.
I kind of hope to, you know, advance my readers in their thinking and see and use my experience to help. You know, help educate them in this market. And, you know, I also wanted to be interactive and fun. Like, I might set up a WhatsApp group for people. You know, if people want to see, or if there's some topical information they want to get my take on, or how I would value a company that's in the news, and, you know, kind of give them a behind the scenes look at how one goes about doing that.
Right. So it sounds like you have a lot of interaction working with other people too. Are there, in terms of investor behavior that you've noticed, say, you said there's lots of, you know, you've seen cycles and fads and trends. Are there any sort of big mistakes that over the years you just see people kind of making over and over again in the investment world?
Well, on the retail side, you know, very often I see people mistaking a good business with a good stock. You know, okay. In bond trading, one of my favorite sayings was, you know, there's no such thing as a bad bond, just a bad price. And at any price, something in theory is investable, and the opposite holds true. In markets, you know, things go in cyclical trends. You know, typically, whichever company or whatever sector is raising the most amount of capital, that's probably the one you want to avoid going forward.
Okay, so let's talk about, say, some industries that might be out of favor right now. I'd be curious to your take. So retail would be an example, right, of something that is out of favor. Have you looked at the retail sector, and, you know, what are your thoughts about something like that?
I haven't really actually specifically looked at the retail sector.
The CEO of Urban Outfitters last week said he thought there was a bubble in the amount of retail locations, at least in the United States, and that was bursting.
Yeah, I've been reading about that. And I think, you know, a lot of these retail stories have never made sense to me. You know, it's usually predicated on land values. But none of these analysis ever look at, well, what it will be the cost of liquidating. Mm-hmm. You know, seriously, you have to fire 300,000 people. Like, that's seriously expensive. Or, you know, everybody talks about Macy's and their flagship store in Manhattan. You know, if you sold that asset and then they leased it, you know, what would that do to earnings? Like, I don't think the bump to prices is nearly as strong as people like. And typically, I always find that when the thesis is predicated on, you know, real estate values,
almost always a bad idea.
Yeah, it's, I've never really seen that work unless it's like an undervalued REIT. Like, yeah. Hotel REITs were crazy cheap in 2009 and 10. You know, those made sense and I invested in those. But, you know, I took a hard look at the coal sector last year. To be honest, I didn't find anything I found investable. There's one I haven't had the time to dive into more that seems kind of interesting.
What about for bonds? Was there anything interesting? Saying like when the commodities got hit hard, was there any bond offerings that you saw that might have been interesting just due to your background?
You know, I did look at that. There was some in that sector. There was some, you know, for example, they would securitize ahead of you. So I did take a really close look at Chesapeake bonds.
Okay.
And there was like this debt equitization, where, you know, they can just hit, senior creditors can jump ahead of you in the line. So you think you're an unsecured bond and you think it's at 40 cents on the dollar. And that's all well and good. But then a bond comes in ahead of you secured by the reserves.
Interesting.
And there's nothing in the indenture to cover you from that. So, you know, I did take a close look at that, but I didn't actually find anything that I found investable.
Did you ever look at, so the fact that you are in Canada, did you ever look at any of the Canadian preferreds last year? And a lot of them plummeted in price?
Yeah, I still, you know, actually I was short those.
Interesting. What was the thesis behind that?
You know, there's such a reach for yield in this world that people are buying securities with yield that they have no business buying. You know, like, historically speaking, preferreds are the worst security in the capital structure. Your upside is a bond yield and your downside is, you know, equity of zero.
So, yeah.
So, you know, banks in Canada were issuing preferreds at sub 4% yields. Historically speaking, you know, a preferred should yield at least 8%. You know, if his historical stock market returns are 7%, you know, if you're in an equity position with no equity upside, you know, you would probably want at least 8%.
I was just going to say, you have banks that sometimes yield 3 or 4% just for the common stock.
Well, exactly. And the other thing that people don't realize is these are resettable, which people think is a good thing, but it's a bad thing because they'll reset off the Canadian 5-year plus a spread. Like, and for a while, the spread was like sub 300 basis points. But that bond, in my opinion, will never get called, right? Because historically speaking, you know, the spread over treasuries that a preferred would be, you know, 400 or 500 basis points. So this is incredibly cheap financing for the banks. And what's interesting is, like, it's a complicated structure, but as interest rates go up, the duration on that bond will extend when people realize, like, oh my gosh, actually they will not take this bond out, or I don't think they will.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you're looking at what you thought was a 5-year bond is now a 30-year bond. So your sensitivity to interest rates has just gone up 4x.
So essentially these companies, the issuers of the preferred stock, they were essentially the smart ones versus the people buying.
I actually spoke to a CFO of a company that did, and he was laughing at the yields that people were paying for them. He thought it was an incredibly cheap form of capital. So actually, I was short those going into some of that turmoil. You know, there was actually a couple that I missed that actually probably were investable, but for the most part, I never invested. I have bought preferreds like in 2008, 2009, 2010 in the U.S., but none in Canada.
Interesting. Do you ever write about bonds in your newsletter, or is it all equity picks that you're talking about?
No, they would be bonds if I think any of them are interesting. You know, at the particular moment in time, I don't find any.
Yep.
I may talk about interesting short bond trades.
A boot.
I'll also talk about them. it won't all be equity, but I think at this particular moment in time, I think it's hard to justify bond ownership.
Interesting.
You know, like if you have the U.S. 10-year at 260 and CPI is printing around 210, 220, yeah, there's, you know, that's not a very attractive proposition in my mind.
Yes. Are there any, just talking about things that are out of favor, are there any sectors that you'll just flat out avoid?
There is. Okay. Biotech.
You won't buy a bond of a biotech company, even if it's cheap enough?
Well, I think the problem with biotech is I just don't understand it.
Okay.
You know, like, every drug sounds promising to me. and it all sounds impressive to me. So I just can't. There's not enough. Like, I just don't have the skill set there.
Yeah.
And even though I live in Canada, I really tend to avoid the resource sector.
I've known one in my whole life. I've met one person who I never actually saw their track record, but they just claimed that they had a good track record around biotech. But this guy literally, 99% of his investing efforts was just reading about biotech companies and like reading like the trade journals and like all the biotech literature. Like that was his like full time like passion. And I feel like if you're not doing that, you probably won't understand it enough. That was just always my take.
No, I totally agree. And, you know, if you look, what's interesting is I think Seth Klarman has a guy like that. Like, if you see a lot of the 13Fs, like, he does have a fair amount of biotech over the years. And I believe that he hired 2 or 3 doctors, and that was their job.
Interesting.
And I think that makes sense. Like, I think there's probably value to be found, you know, having a fundamental understanding of these things.
Well, yeah, because it's probably less competition. Especially in today's world where it's so hard to get alpha, that any sort of edge that you have or any kind of marketplace where there's less competition for what you're doing, it's especially useful in today's world.
I totally agree. Unfortunately, I do not possess those skills, but
likewise.
Yeah, to people that do, good for you. I think there could be interesting things there. I just wouldn't have a clue.
Yeah. Do you have any, I mean, you have quite an amount of industry experience. Do you have any advice for people just starting out in the investing world or who want to get into the investing world?
Yeah, I kind of have two big philosophies on this. I think when you're first starting off, I think I really encourage people to try everything.
Okay.
Like really diversify you know, both your portfolio and your strategies. You know, try merger arb, try deep value investing, try net-net investing. You know, look at GARP companies. You know, look at real estate, private businesses, short selling. You know, look at all of that for a couple of reasons. One, you know, there's often a lot of philosophical overlap that you can learn through all these strategies. And it also teaches you to look at investing from different lenses. You know, what may look cheap in one strategy may look grossly expensive when looked at from a different point of view, and vice versa. And, yep. You know, often good money can be made entering into a strategy with a different view or when that strategy has become out of favor. So I think it just gives you, you know, a broader range of what's possible and a broader range or toolkit when looking at different companies. And, you know, from doing that, I think you understand more your competency and your own risk tolerance.
Right.
And I think that's very important to find. You know, like personally, I don't really like merger arbitrage. Like I'll do it occasionally, but, you know, just my personality, I much rather own an option than sell one, which is effectively what you do in a merger arbitrage. And I know the academics suggest it still, the risk adjusted returns are pretty good, but it just doesn't suit me or my personality.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, as an investor starting out, I think that's really important to understand. Like you have to learn how to handle the volatility and tailor your investment style to that. You know, because if you take huge concentrated portfolio bets, which, you know, sometimes I do, but if that causes you to get nervous, you know, you can sell at the wrong time. You know, you need to find a strategy that you can intellectually follow through with that will typically generate the highest returns that someone is capable of. And I think, you know, going through that process of trying lots of different things is probably the best way to go about that. And then I think you also realize through that process that everything is cyclical, like ideas, strategies. There's nothing really new in investments. So you can notice what ideas or sectors are out of favor and see if you can take advantage of that. And then, you know, you try and through that, you gain more experience, you read more, you have kind of a broader understanding of markets. And I think that's to everyone's benefit.
Interesting. So, talking about your process, what would you say your process is? What would you say your niche is, your process in terms of when you're doing research for your investments? And then follow up question would be, are you willing to talk about any kind of particular investments on the show if you're willing?
Yeah, of course. So my style is kind of bifurcated. I tend to like to buy, you know, good companies that everybody does, but usually only well below their fair value. So I tend to be quite patient on that. Or I like finding mispriced securities with a lot more upside than downside. So I tend to be quite disciplined, quite long-term, and I tend to look at areas of the market where volatility or apathy, you know, can create opportunity. But I also like to take a creative view to investing into businesses. So I tend to like to look, you know, what's the liquidation value? You know, what would a competitor pay for this? Or a venture capital? What part of the capital structure might be the most interesting? That tends to be my style.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when I look at companies, I typically look for something I don't like right away. You know, kind of find quickly what, you know, something that would eliminate something for you. So, you know, one of my more favored positions at the moment is a small company in Canada called Macro Enterprises.
Okay.
A pipeline servicing company. There's actually a sample write-up on my website if anybody's interested. But this is a company that trades for just a little bit more than their cash value. And they have a whole bunch of equipment that's probably undervalued on their balance sheet. And what's interesting about them is they have a revolver from TD and Business Development Bank for almost two times their market cap. And the reason for that is, you know, in 2013, there was this huge LNG boom that was speculated to occur in Western Canada. And it kind of made sense because, you know, with the Marcellus Basin in the U.S., there isn't a ton of demand for Alberta gas. So they, you know, Canada needs an external market for this product. So 20 different LNG projects were announced. And so far, none have been built. Although one, there's meant to be a decision in the next month or two whether it goes forward or not. But if any of these projects come through, Macros tends to benefit quite handsomely from it. And so you're looking at if the company was liquidated, mm-hmm. you know, I think the value would be, you know, $83 million versus a market cap of, I believe it's around 60 at the moment, 65.
And what percentage of your own personal portfolio is that?
Oh, this position?
Yeah.
Roughly 5%.
Okay.
But if an LNG project hits, they think it takes, you know, roughly $30 million of working capital per $100 million of revenue. You know, the historical margins are 22%. So you could be looking at a scenario where this company could be making $40 million in a year. So you could see this home run scenario, but still a lot of protection from a very strong balance sheet. You know, it's a pipeline servicing company, but it's been run intelligently. A lot of these companies levered up, did equipment financing and so on and so forth. These guys have almost no debt and the CEO owns 33% of the shares. They're looking to buy back shares currently. They just announced the NCIB. And these are the type of securities I really like, where, you know, you have this huge embedded option that you get for free, but not a lot of downside.
Yeah. Interesting.
You know, it could take a long time to play out. If LNG doesn't happen, then they're just looking at servicing work, which I think would still be decent. But, you know, in that scenario, I still think as a shareholder, you do quite well. But that's something I like at the moment.
Do you ever, since you are Canadian, do you ever look at any Canadian warrants?
No, not really. Actually, I would say 90% of my investments are in the U.S.
Okay, interesting.
Like my biggest Canadian position is actually a short.
Okay.
Primarily, you know, Canadian housing bubble type short.
What's the company?
Well, I have a couple. One's the currency. That's worked out nicely over the last couple of years. Another would be Genworth Canada. They're the big Canadian mortgage insurer. You know, in Canada, a lot of these companies tend to have small or very low reserves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you look at an American bank, you know, it'll have somewhere between, you know, 1 to 2%, you know, kind of loan loss provision. You know, some of these companies that are second and third tier lenders are, you're talking sub 10 basis points. You know, and you're looking at 10 to 20 time levered balance sheet, in, you know, what I believe is a housing bubble. So I find, like, on the banking side, I found those very interesting. And then, you know, as a mortgage insurer, you know, they have $3.5 billion of equity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have $440 billion of insured mortgages. And even if you just look at the last 5 or 6 years, that's over $100 billion of mortgages, at an LTV of around 97%. You know, there, as you know, in these market booms, there tends to be a lot of fraud. You know, misappraisals, people doctoring income statements and all this type of stuff. And Genworth, in my opinion, has adverse selection. You know, because as a bank, if you're going to get mortgage insurance, you'd much rather have it from the CMHC, which is the Canadian government agency that does mortgage insurance. You know, Canadian banks once they get insurance through them, hold no capital. With Genworth, they still do. So Genworth has this adverse selection, and I think excess leverage. Historically speaking, defaults in Canada have been very low.
Okay.
Most people talk like, you know, 70 basis points. But Fannie and Freddie was very low, and then, you know, the default rate was 7%. So even if you said, you know, there's a 7% default rate and housing prices are down 30%, which actually I think they dropped a lot more than that. But you would see Genworth taking 27% of losses on over $100 billion times, it would keep the math, let's say 10% defaults. You're looking at $2.7 billion of losses. And that's ignoring all the losses on the other $300 million they have insured. So that's probably one of my favorite. And then there's a couple second and third tier lenders that, you know, I'll probably be discussing in future. Future issues, and then I think some puts.
Okay.
I think most value investors just look at stocks, but I'll kind of look at, you know, cheapness in anything that I think I can quantify.
Yeah.
You know, for example, like the Canadian currency, I thought for too long was overvalued, and you know, through back of the envelope calculations, you kind of figure this stuff out, and you know, I will look at opportunities like that.
What was your analysis on why the Canadian currency was overvalued?
Sure. So this is back when it was trading at parity with the U.S. dollar.
Okay.
You know, unfortunately, I've been in this some of these short positions for 3-4 years now. But unfortunately, I mean, because these things play out longer than I'd ever anticipated. But so it's at parity. But everything in Canada is roughly 25% more expensive. So if you look at like purchasing power parity, it's usually like 20-25%. And then given the reliance on the Canadian economy on housing, I really felt that if there'd be any wobble in Canadian housing, we've had a couple, we would see central bank cuts. So if you look at the Canadian 10-year now, I believe it's at, you know, 1.7%. And the U.S. 10-year, that's at, call it 2.7%. I think it's 2.6 and change. That's 100 basis point difference over 10 years, right?
Yeah.
So then you could add, that's another 10% difference, like just an interest rate differential. And so that gets you to 135, which is where we currently are. I think the interest rate differential gets bigger from here. I'm not as convinced as I was when it was at parity. That was kind of in my mind, a no-brainer. But, you know, just adding the purchasing parity plus interest rate differentials are what I expected them to be in the future. You know, to me, that clearly showed the Canadian dollar was overvalued. I think you could say the same thing here, but it's not as compelling.
I think it's interesting the way you talk about all these ideas. It's almost like someone describing to me like a soap opera or something. It's like, this is this, and then this happens, and this company did blah, blah. You find this very entertaining, don't you?
I do. It really is like a passion and a hobby to me. You know, like what I also encourage people to do is, you know, think of businesses and investing, you know, like you would a reality TV show. Like, it's kind of the best form of nonfiction reading that I can think of. You know, like quarterly, you have companies that update you on, you know, the risks they've taken and did it work, did it not work, rolling out new projects, you know, levering up to buy other companies, you know, or, you know, dishonest management. It's not hard to find stories of them. You know, did it come back to bite them or did they get away with it? You know, so, you know, some people talk about watch lists and are they useful, are they not useful? But, you know, I kind of have just an entertainment list. You know, throughout the years, you read and take a look at so many different companies that I just keep a list just to see, like, how is it doing? How is this thesis playing out? Even if I don't have any investments. You know, for example, Bob Diamond left Barclays Bank, and he started an African bank, kind of like an African bank roll-up type strategy, which if you think of demographic trends in Africa and how unbanked, you know, lots of the population is, like, that's a fascinating idea.
Yeah.
But for shareholders, being an unmitigated disaster. I think it IPO'd at 15 and now it trades at 3. But these are stories that, you know, I just can't help myself but follow. You know, David's Tea is another good example in Canada. You know, I'm a tea drinker. I like their product. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a Canadian operation that appears to have a 40% ROE. And then they expand in the States and that, you know, is a negative 20% ROE. So you have a company that with an incredible business in Canada, you know, expanded the States as, you know, it does make sense. Your market's obviously a lot bigger than ours. And it really just hasn't worked out.
I will tell you though, as an American, David's Tea is far superior to Teavana, just so you know.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
Totally. So that's one, you know, where I'll probably go to the annual meeting this year. You know, I'll just buy one share or something like that. And I just find it fascinating. I don't think it's quite cheap enough, but these are the stories I follow kind of globally. Just because I'm interested. I think it's fascinating watching all this occur. Or there's another Canadian company, Datawind, which I also haven't invested in. But, mm-hmm. you know, they try to provide cheap internet in India, specifically in other poorer countries. And how they do it is when somebody in India on a tablet clicks on a website, they actually take a picture of a PDF in Canada and send it to them. So the data goes from the data usage shrinks massively. I don't know how you value something like that, but I'm super interested to see if they can pull it off.
Yeah.
And I encourage everybody to, you know, think of business and investing that way, almost from an entertainment point of view. I think you learn more, and it can only help your returns going forward.
Very interesting. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about while you're here?
I think we covered most of it. The only other thing I would think about too, I guess, what I would also encourage readers would be, you know, the concept of, you know, what's the investor's end game?
Okay.
And you know, when I was on the trading desk, we'd often have these philosophical discussions like, you know, what is it that we actually do all day trading these corporate bonds? And, you know, one of the smart senior traders said, well, really what you're doing or what you should be thinking of is training yourself to buy your own business. You know, here we are looking at different capital structures, different financing structures, you know, the possibility of LBOs, the different capital structures, all that different type of stuff. You know, that should be used to thinking about, okay, what would you do if you owned your own business? Or how would you go about buying your own? And I thought that was super interesting. And it really wasn't anything that had occurred to me at the time, but I immediately thought, like, you know what, that is the correct attitude and that is the correct approach to this. And with public markets, you know, there always is that option. You know, for some reason, that's why I find the nano caps so interesting too, just because, you know, in theory, some of these $10 million market caps, it doesn't take a lot of capital and it may not be that hard for some people to actually, you know, you could try. And there's been some fascinating case studies almost recently where activists have gone after, you know, nano cap stocks with great success. And that's kind of been interesting to watch. So I think that's another thing investors should keep in mind is that, you know, kind of take a step back and realize that you can look at this holistically. And, you know, if you play a longer term picture, like maybe that is something that is possible for some people.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, if people want to know more about your newsletter or even potentially sign up, What's the best way for people to find out more information or get in contact with you?
Well, I would love to hear from people. My email is tim@onbeyondinvesting.com. You can check out my website at onbeyondinvesting.com. I'm on Twitter, although very rarely actually on Twitter, but I'm at onbeyondinvest. And if any of your readers want to reach out, I'm happy to send them a copy of my newsletter so they know what it's like. And, you know, as maybe you've already picked up, you know, I love discussing this stuff. I love discussing markets, companies, investing techniques. And I'd love to hear from anybody with thoughts or ideas or anything of that nature. And, you know, if they want to subscribe, feel free to.
All right, great. Well, Tim, I really appreciate you being on the show. And I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me, Eric.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.